Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, on this Tuesday, March 17th. And today we are going to be taking a step into our past, talking with folks that are doing important work on translating old Hawaiian newspapers. First, we will talk with Dr. Puakea Nogelmeyer, an associate professor of the Hawaiian language at the University of Hawaii Manoa, and who also serves as the director of a nonprofit organization dedicated to publication of scholarly texts. Aloha and welcome to the show.
Hey, aloha, Carly. Mahalo for having us here.
Oh, my pleasure. Now, Puakea, you've worked on a lot of research projects and used Hawaiian accounts from the past, but your largest project has been this newspaper translation project that you're working on. Can you tell us a little bit about how it began and what you're doing?
Well, our largest one really is not a translation, but a transcription.
Okay.
Because we started to pull the Hawaiian language newspapers and put images up so they'd be available on the internet. They still weren't searchable. They're just pictures of old newspapers. So doing a transcription project to make them word searchable, still in Hawaiian. But that sort of introduced them to the world, a larger world. That's where the science folk got involved. Sea Grant was the first one in the door to say, aren't there things in here that relate to us? So then we started to pull out articles and translate them. Which is a whole different kind of project. You gotta, you know, identify the individual article, get it out, translate it, make it make sense. So that's really the umbrella project that we're on right now, because Sea Grant's model was followed by GIMAR, which was picked up by College of Ed, and now we've got astronomers and archaeologists and people that they're trying to make use of the resource. So we become, right now we're kind of a bottleneck, but we're at least a pathway there.
Well, it's a huge undertaking. And what was the original thought or idea? What gave you the, what sparked the idea to start all of this?
Well, we knew in the language circle, I mean, the more research we did, we knew how large the resource was. Hawaiians started newspapers in the 1830s, 1834, and sort of nationally decided, let's put our knowledge here. It'll be safe. They did not invest much in books because books are so frozen.
Yeah.
And the newspapers allowed sort of a collective input. But you had a little nation, with almost universal literacy. So everybody could participate. So they put, you know, historical knowledge and cultural knowledge. But in the course of that, they also did the everyday reports of what was happening. The newspapers were all national. So somebody's writing from Kauai, Kau is reading it, or Molokai is writing, and Lanai is reading and maybe writing back. Yeah. So they'd often give reports, and a lot of that was what today we'd call almost citizen science, saying, well, the fish catches this year are different than last year, or these weather events happened, or this is how the tide is operating right now. Lots of reports on the world around them. So, and changes, any changes that were occurring. They were writing about it, and there was discussion. Well, today, the scientists are delighted to find out that that's there.
Sure.
So we started to, initially, it was simply what kinds of articles related to fishing practices, and that's what Sea Grant was interested in. Fishing methods, fishing ethos, kind of, you know, what were the guides and the rules? What were the laws? Those have been built on now, because we find these pieces that then, well, if there's that, what is there on this? You know, and so the last bunch that we were bringing out had to do with runoff and how it was affecting the fisheries. There was a city being built. Honolulu kept developing and kept expanding. Now we've got sewage and stuff, and you know, how is that affecting the reef? And the, well, there's articles in the paper that are describing it.
Wow. Now, how does the format differ from today's newspaper format? Is there similarities or differences?
That's a great question, because, I mean, today's newspapers, really, I put them in my yard to keep the weeds down. These newspapers, at the end of the year, they would bring them back and have them bound as a book because the newspaper contained the news. And actually, interestingly, the news was usually on page 2 and 3, you know, of a 4-page full size of the Wall Street Journal, but 4 pages.
Right.
But the middle would be what's fresh because they would print page 1 and 4 in advance. Because oftentimes that was an ongoing, like a serial column on history or maybe legends. They loved literature, so that was in there. Anything that could be done in advance would be on the outside pages. But it contained all the reports, what's happening with the churches around the island chain, what's happening with the government. There's pieces on cultural practice today, cultural things in the past, educational things, anything legal. I mean, so really it was everything that we get today for our entertainment, our news, our education, our play. All of that was in one place. So if you imagine that they were the television, computer, and game station of the past.
So what personally speaks to you in these historic papers? What interests you the most when you read them?
That's really hard because the more we've made them accessible, I mean, I in effect started learning Hawaiian through these 40 years ago. But it was real piecemeal. We put together such a large resource that now I'm actually addicted. I'm badly addicted. I'll launch into something that interests me. And on the same page, there'll be something else that piques my interest. I'll go wander, follow, well, where did that start? Go to the previous issue, go to the previous year. I can lose 2 and 3 hours. So my favorite piece is probably historical literature. The poetry that's in the newspapers is incredible. We did, when we were trying to do education about this resource, one of the things we did is we pulled poems, their chants, from the newspapers. And we presented them for a modern audience because they were only known in print. So we put them to voice. But in a day or 2 days, we were able to pull 700 mele.
Wow.
And that's what we offered to our chanters to say, you know, pick your choose, or if you'd like to go look further. But in a couple of days, we could easily call out 700 examples. So the newspapers ran for 114 years. So there's this huge block to draw from. When the science folk, now Sea Grant had a focus. They wanted fishing method, fishing stories. Jaimar jumped in and said, weather stuff, you know, climate, you know, mm-hmm. And the unaimed arrow never misses, right? So I put a bunch of kids on it. We started pulling by a word list. We pulled 4,000 articles on everything you can think of, from deluges to droughts to, you know, there's even a few eclipses in there just as, you know, or eruptions and things. Turns out that, I mean, the folks who were after it was really, they were more interested in hurricanes. Huh. And actually in a particular hurricane, they thought it might be a hurricane. There was a reference to a hurricane that had hit Hawaii Island. Hmm. Now, they only had a couple of references from, you know, like mission out stations. 1874, I think, was it? Paige might be able to speak to this more in detail. But he said, you know, is there any reports on this storm? There was a storm that it seems like it could have been a hurricane. Well, we went through just the ones that we'd pulled. There were 16 different articles.
Wow.
You know, Kona is, you know, writing up, this is what happened. Waipio is writing up Maui. Well, they were able to take the detail from our translations on the kinds of trees that were felled, the kinds of buildings that were affected and whatnot. And they were able to say, this is a level 3 hurricane that came up through Waipio Valley, smacked Hamakua and Kohala, and then moved on to Maui. What's really critical is when we were pulling this stuff, there was legislation in the legislature proposing that Hawaii Island be able to drop hurricane insurance. Sort of the modern urban belief is that they're immune, that the mountains help keep them, you know, protected in a way. So this data really proved that, no, you're not immune, and you're actually overdue. So that legislation was dropped. They are still hurricane insured. So when Isel did come to visit, They were still insured.
That's amazing. I mean, what an amazing resource to be able to take that historic knowledge and apply it in modern day and have some real-time evidence that you can
use. That's a definite impact. Or even to be able to look at the fish catches, the kinds of catches that were happening, what were the market sensibilities, for instance, what was being sold as opposed to what was being eaten. It's really interesting in the size of the catch. Being able to compare that for 190 years instead of just the last 50 or 60 years where our records go.
Sure. Now, you mentioned a little bit of a bottleneck because, you know, now there's all these people that want this information and see the value in it. How do you access all this information and process it? You know, you have a huge volunteer network and obviously a lot of students that assist.
Well, we had a giant volunteer network for the transcribing, for typing up and making things. We actually had volunteers in 12 countries.
Wow.
We did a project that was only 9 months long. We did worldwide PR, and we got 3,000 volunteers.
Amazing.
To type newspapers. Because you can do it as well as I can,
mm-hmm.
right? You don't need to understand what you're typing. But when we go to culling, you know, pulling the articles, translating them, now you narrow down to, it's a really kind of a small pool. We're doing a lot of Hawaiian language training at the university, and there's the university at Hilo. They're using these materials, but not extensively. So the familiarity with language from a century and a half ago, or 2 centuries ago almost, there's a smaller pool to draw from. So there's me. There's a cadre of folk, you know, I mean, teachers and whatnot. And I mean, I'm a full prof now. I've been playing with this. And we've got profs, other associate profs and whatnot, who can do this, but they're mostly overworked. There's not a lot of time for them. So we're taking the students who have, they're adept at the language and turning them into researcher translators. So talk to Paige in Monaco and you'll find that they're actually building a skill set so that they can do this.
Sure. And is the language, the Hawaiian language that you see in the newspapers, is that slightly different from the modern Hawaiian that's spoken?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I mean, and we really worked toward building fluency. I mean, Hawaiian's been pulled, you know, in the 1970s, they thought Hawaiian would be dead in 10 years. And a dead language is never recoverable. It didn't die. There was an incredible revitalization movement. And worldwide, it's actually, Hawaii's seen as a huge success. But the focus was on fluency, not on connection or, you know, bridging to the past so much. Only now we're giving that more focus. So a lot of the kids learn language very fluently, but there's older forms of the language that they're less familiar with.
Sure.
So some of this can be really befuddling, you know. Yeah, and look how just English has changed in 150 years. You read a novel from 1830 and see how much of it makes
significantly clear sense. Different.
Yeah. It's huge.
Now, so you were not born and raised speaking Hawaiian.
No. And I'm not Hawaiian.
What was your path to learning the language?
And it's a story that would fill up your hour already. So, but basically, I get here by accident. I'm supposed to be here for a weekend, and it's now 40-some years. I'm just a fun guy. I have no interest in Hawaiian anything other than food is always fun. But I got involved in the 70s in hula.
Mm.
And that actually opened a whole pathway into language. The old gentleman that I worked with on language, I didn't come to the university. I learned it in the neighborhood. And he was a translator of old newspapers.
Ah.
So that was sort of my port of entry. Then I came to the university, ended up as a student, and I've never not been entertained.
It's amazing the steps we take in our lives, what it leads to, huh?
You could never have choreographed this dance. Yeah.
Now, you also have an interesting background that you're an acclaimed songwriter. So how did that play into all of this?
You know, it's a side run.
Okay.
A lot of the way that I learned Hawaiian, a lot of it was translating old mele from the newspapers with this old gentleman. So my introduction between that and hula, which is all about mele. So I actually started writing chants, and then I took to writing songs.
Okay.
And because I sing rather badly. So if I write nice lyrics, people who sing really well sing them.
Oh. Right.
So my stuff has been recorded by people with great voices, and that kind of keeps that interest going. Yeah. So they've always run, they align with each other.
That's amazing. And as you go through the newspapers over time, I'm sure you're finding new, discovering new things with every day.
Every day. Every day I find something I'm enthused about. There's something new, something, even if it's just a turn of phrase in a mele, in an old mele. But a lot of times it'll be like, we'll trip across a description of something that it's so clear, it's so useful. It's interesting to me, but, you know, I'll think. And I forward things off almost every day. I'll send an article to Liz. You know, here's something that they said about Hanauma in 1855. You know, here's something. I have a network in my head of people that I know appreciate. And so I'll send it off and say, is this of interest to you? I might do a quick translation or a summary or something. And if they're interested, we'll get them a formal translation.
That's amazing.
It's fun.
So now you're doing a lot of the work with the newspapers through the University of Hawaii and working with the students. How does the nonprofit that you work with come into play?
Well, it's the university doesn't really have a niche for a lot of the work we're doing. So the projects that I have, like Manakau, Page, and other ones on, are umbrellaed at the university, but the nonprofit is really sort of the resource that we use for training translators. So the university hasn't yet sort of got that niche together, okay. So we do that on the side, and that's my work, is to give people the skill set I've developed, you know, and to build a strong ability so they can just go out and do what needs done. The university, we're working toward integrating it, is what happens.
Excellent. And what do you like most about working with the students on the newspapers?
There's lots to like there. I mean, because they're already bright and skilled by the time I get them. You know, I'm not dealing with beginners. So they bring to the work their own vision and whatnot. But also seeing how fast they move, and they develop a confidence and ability. And just watching that unfold is always real rewarding. They also find really cool stuff on their own that they bring to me, so it expands my reach a little bit.
Yeah. Excellent. And so how much, how many students do you have currently working on the project, and do you have goals for completion? I mean, this is something that probably could be easily done in 200 years, 300 years.
There's
so
go.
Much information there. I mean,
there's a lot of it that can be done.
Yeah.
I only, getting GRA ships is, you know, it's a difficult piece.
Sure.
I had explained to, like, the Jaimar folk who are trying to do the atmospheric research and whatnot. So what I really need is I need 5 GRA ships. Put them all on task at once. Let me work with them. Build a skill set that then you can tap into forever. Because I'm not forever. I'm supposed to retire in a year. And so we need to build the cadre of folk who can. Mm-hmm. Now, they could only put out 1 GRA ship. Same with Sea Grant. You know, if they had their way, if they had the funding, they would actually bring, because every time we put one of the students in this slot, it builds their preparedness to do it on their own. Yeah. And that's what we aim for. So if Sea Grant had their way, they'd have 10 students under me, and we'd be just thumping all the time. But really, I only usually have 3 or 4 operating on different projects, mm-hmm. and we've only ever had the luxury of like 1 on each project. So Paige does atmosphere and the climate world. Monaco's doing fish. You know, some of the other ones are in the College of Ed. They've picked up on this science material, got a good grant from NSF to incorporate regional science accounts from the past into modern science curriculum. So they're doing these STEM classes. You want to learn about winds? Well, here's a story about a windstorm on Kauai. Now let's look at the other winds on Kauai. Let's look at the concept of wind. Let's look at the world winds, you know, and bring it out into the broadest reach of science.
Yeah.
It's really, it's a great notion. Pauline Chin has been dynamic in this and brought in a great team. So one project is feeding another project, which is great.
And are you seeing now, a cohort building of the students that have accessed the newspapers and are working together to continue on projects after they move on from
Definitely.
These GR ships?
Yeah, if we don't have a GRA ship, there are other folks that are looking for translation. They're able to step in there. I or somebody, one of my closer team, helps them with the hard parts. Because, mm-hmm. You can do 90% of it. It's actually pretty workable. It's the 10% that's deadly. And the 10% can keep you from seeing 70 of the 90. So it's,
sure.
It can block it all up. But if you have somebody you can ask the questions and get answers from, it can clear up lots of things. It enables lots of work. So that's where we're building a cadre. They can do it on their own. They still have a reference guy. And they're becoming the reference guys.
Huh. So in your retirement plans, do you continue to plan to work on the newspapers?
Actually, we call it retirement. I'm actually stepping over to do the translator training on a full-time basis.
Oh, that's fantastic.
That's the plan. So, yeah, I have no plan to retire. They'll have to close the coffin on me, I'm sure.
You don't strike me as someone who's going to slow down anytime soon.
It's not my plan, yeah. But no, I think that we're trying to integrate this idea of training translators, trying to do that at the university. It's moving too slow for me.
Sure.
So just to kind of speed it up, we very much in the last 10 years changed the landscape by opening up all these resources, by introducing the science community, the history community, the culture community, introducing them to this. We've created a need, and we need to now fill that need. The university is not going to be able to do it fast enough. I need to invest while I'm lively, while caffeine still works.
Sure. And even, within the science profession, you're seeing a lot more expansion outside of just the facts and the numbers to incorporate a lot more of social science, humanities.
Definitely.
The people aspect, which is very important to do. At least I think so.
Oh, it's giant.
Yeah.
And it brings that into a place where the community, the people that really
sure.
need that information, can incorporate it.
Yeah. Well, I could talk to you all day about this.
And we will.
It's
we'll
amazing.
Go out for coffee one day.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. Yeah. We're going
to
take a quick break because I want to divulge more into some of the history and what the students are doing. So we'll take a quick break and we'll come back to talking about these historic resources.
Man, do I love card night. You ready, boys? You got a king?
Go, Fish Dad!
Oh, come on! This is WWE superstar Titus O'Neil. The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Learn more at 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal. And joining us now is Paige Okumara, a graduate student in the Hawaiian Language Master's Program, working with the Joint Institute for Marine and Atmospheric Research, or JIMAR. And she is translating and researching weather events archived in Hawaiian language newspapers. She also is no stranger to radio as the general manager for KTUH-FM, UH Manoa's student-run live radio station. Welcome to the show, Paige.
Aloha.
Aloha. And Paige, we've heard a lot about this project already, and you obviously have some amazing resources and people to work with. What first got you interested into your approach to the research?
Well, I guess it would start that I declared my major to be Hawaiian language as an undergraduate.
It's a good start.
But I did hit a point in my undergraduate work where I wasn't sure what I was going to do with myself after, which I think is a question that we get asked all the time. What are you going to do with your degree? Mm-hmm. And so what had happened was the transcription project started and they were hiring for student help. So I applied and I was hired, and that was back in 2011, I believe. So it started there, and back then I was doing really grunt work stuff because my skills weren't where they were supposed to be to do anything more than that. But from there, because I was already working in the body of research material, That's where I really started to get interested in what I was doing. And for us as students, unfortunately, although the newspapers are such a big resource for us, and it's a big deal for us now, as undergraduates, sometimes you could perhaps go through your degree and not have delved into it. So if it weren't for me getting hired on the transcription project first, then I probably wouldn't even be working on this stuff today. But that's when I first started seeing what was there and comparing what exists and has sat there for hundreds of years that we just didn't know was there. And so sometimes we're just a little ignorant to our own history, I think, here. And so that's really where I started. And then I graduated and got accepted into the master's program. And so that's what I like to do now, is my research.
Sure. Well, you obviously have to have a passion for it. And do you find yourself becoming more interested and more passionate, you know, sort of like going down the rabbit hole that we talked about as you continue to sort through all of these historic resources?
Definitely. I think what happens is we always start someplace. We start at one place, and maybe within one article under that overlying subject, we find something else that'll branch off, and maybe we follow the branch or we save it for later. But I think there's also in my everyday life, if there's something that I'm thinking about and I'm wondering what are the accounts historically, then now I think at this point in time, now I have the skill set to actually go look for it myself. Mm-hmm. So every day I feel like I go through my day and maybe I'm thinking about one thing, but you know, I'm a little bit ADD sometimes. So I can be working on one thing, but then I'll also think, well, while I'm sitting here doing this, can I also look up, you know, A, B, C, and D?
Sure.
So there's always something to do. There's always something, whether it's finding something funny or interesting or something that I just can't even understand on my own, then it just makes you a little more interested to find out.
Sure. Is there something that speaks to you in particular about the information that you're gathering?
For me, what I focus on or what really strikes me as I'm working are the differences in the language then and the language that we learn and we use today. Because there are things that have dropped or fallen out of our normal scope, or because we always say that, you know, we're also fluent in English. Usually English is our first language. So how has the English language affected the way we understand meanings for our Hawaiian language? Or sometimes we're so used to using a term one way that if I see it and it's kind of turned upside down, then that's something not for us to just, you know, mark off and throw to the side as, you know, an anomaly, but to really focus and double back on ourselves and think, well, what is it that we are misunderstanding or what have we lost? So for me, whenever I do my research or I'm looking, reading, translating, it always strikes me as to peg the things that we've lost between then and now, whether it be a factual history thing or within the language. I think those are things that usually make me stop and take a moment.
Yeah. And that's powerful stuff. I mean, you are basically acting as the connectors from the past to the future, and that's a huge responsibility. Yeah. So, Paige, what got you interested in the specific subject matter that you're looking at within the newspapers?
So for this, for my work with Jaimar, what it is I'm assigned to this project.
Okay.
So what really puts me here first was the language, to research in the language. But also, I feel like we have seen more in the past 10 years or so than before, the effects of climate change, weather events. We've experienced seismic events. We are experiencing a volcanic event now. So all of those things tie into my research. And you know, I think for me, it's really important because these are things that we live. It's not really a theoretical thing anymore.
Yeah.
We experience them on a daily. And to be able to look at it through a lens, you know, that's over 100 years old, gives us more color to the picture, gives us a more full perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What are some of those differences that you've noted in reading some accounts of historic weather and comparing that to present day?
Well, I think for me, because I was specifically assigned so far to look at seismic events mm-hmm. and ocean events. So tsunamis, which I think is now the accepted technical term, right? Mm-hmm. Versus tidal wave, because the tidal, yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, without getting way into it. But these are, the thing is, sometimes there aren't differences. It's happened before. We're just always surprised or shocked because in our lifetime, maybe it hasn't right. happened.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when I have to look at accounts of volcanic eruptions, they're rather dynamic and bombastic in the report because that's part of how every day I think this generation of media, social media, internet, radio, we're so used to being surrounded by information that we're almost a little desensitized to it.
Sure.
But back then, once you got your newspaper and you open it up, that's when, if somebody didn't tell you already, you probably learned that there was an eruption and this many people died and, you know, all these different events that occurred on that one day or a span of a week, however long. So perhaps, you know, the biggest difference now is that we have such quick access to information and scientists have been able to predict things that we can prepare ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
But when you read these accounts, sometimes there are no preparations. Things just started to happen. Children died. Animals died. You know, people were lost at sea. Houses were swept all the way up the mountain at some point. And I think it's important for us to be able to acknowledge and know that it did happen. That way we don't kind of go about our life only recollecting from what's recorded, you know, in the past 50 years.
Sure. So how were the time frames spanned on the newspapers? Were they daily or weekly, or how did they come out?
So I can answer this because this has been definitely drilled in my head for the past 3 years or so. So we start in 1834. Kalama Hawaii is the first publication out of Maui, out of Lahaina Luna School. And we span over 100 years. Some newspapers were daily, some were weekly. Some Kanupepakuoko ran for 70 years. Yeah. Which was the longest running.
And 100 different newspapers.
Over 100 different newspapers. So it's a very, very large body of history.
Mostly weekly.
Weekly. And so in the work that you've done, going through all of these papers and looking at these seismic events, and is there anything that's been surprising to you or a particular story or article that's really connected with you?
There's one account, and it's rather a long one, in 1877 about an eruption on Mauna Loa. And it was rather large, and lots of people died. And I think part of why the article stuck with me, you know, throughout these past 6 months or so that I've been working is that, you know, we have detailed accounts and there's data there that sometimes we don't think is data because it's in a story. But it really is data. And it's, to me, it's something that scientists or everyday people should be able to use in knowing that this happened. This is the chain of events that occurred. This is how far the lava reached or how quickly it ran to the ocean. So there's that hard data running in this story, but there's also the emotional side of it. It's a detailed account of, on top of the volcano erupting, there was, you know, a tsunami that came with it and children died. People ran and left their children. And they were finding children that had passed away, but were trying to hide in the cracks of rocks. And so it just really, it's such an emotional account, but also there's hard data there for us to use later. So that's definitely one. Another one that stuck with me Partly because I didn't proofread it before I brought it in.
Oh.
So then I learned the importance of proofreading. Oh, so,
'cause it came with daggers.
Oh, yeah. So there's that for me, my own personal development is no matter how interesting it is, if I'm working on it at 3 a.m, that should not go straight to Kumo after. That right. should be proofread. But also because it had later on after maybe 3 read-throughs, what started out as me translating it as red dirt, because that's what it said in the article, changed into maybe I thought it was ash, because the account at the end of this long article about this red dirt that just came out of the volcano and covered everything, it said it wasn't hot. It was cold. So then I thought, well, maybe it was volcanic ash. But later on, it turned out to be a mudslide.
Yeah.
And I'm not even sure how we got. But part of that is, as people who are experiencing this and don't necessarily know what it is, and it's the first time within their lifetime that they've seen this happen, how do they describe that event? Without, for us, it's so easy. We can just Google. I saw this today. What do the science people call it? But for them, it's kind of how they described it. And at the end of the day, proofread, you know, 3 times, I missed something. I still missed somewhere in there. I didn't recognize that it was a mudslide. So for me, that's my own personal professional development.
That's an amazing example. And, you know, never really thought of it this way, but there's probably so much more raw emotion tied to it because yeah. you don't know what it is. And it's this first encounter.
They're very personal accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And but valuable for the data included, but yeah. much more experiential than what you get off the news.
Sure.
For the
most well, part. I guess they go back and forth. So sometimes, I guess because those are very dynamic events, you know, there's a lot of emotion tied to it. When people die or animals die, people are lost. But there's also the everyday accounts that I do have to call through, the short ones that just say, gosh, it was really hot today in Honolulu. Like, really hot. You know, and it's such a short account. Mm-hmm. For us, it's so easy because we can check our phones or the news and it'll tell us the weather is going to be really hot today. But back then, you experienced it when it happened. So, you know, it's written down on this day. It was hot on this day. It rained on this day. You know, it was hot and rainy and the steam was coming up the off of the pavement on the sidewalk. So there are some really non-emotional accounts that are still worth, you know, pegging the seasons of how maybe winter came late this year because they're saying, mm-hmm. oh, it's cold now, but it last year was colder sooner than today. And
much more descriptive, too, in the accounts, huh?
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Wow. So when you're not mesmerized by the stories and the data coming out of the papers, well, how do you have a standard method that you use to go through all the information? Do you have keywords that you pull, or how do you focus a search within the papers?
So it always depends. So I guess part of my job is a directed research. So perhaps Jaimar will dictate, we'd like you to look at this specifically right now. So from there, we already have the database generated that we talked about with 4,000 some articles.
Right.
So luckily for me, since that's already generated, I just need to go in there. And they've already been categorized by weather event, or we just say event. So what type of article, what is it talking about? So for me, I'm lucky. I can just go straight there and use even an English search term. But if it's something where I have to double check or maybe go outside of the database to pull, then yes, we would go into
word list.
Our word list, you know, checking, kind of double checking, cross checking with articles in the dictionary about what other terms are relative to that certain type of event.
The initial word list will often produce new words to be searching.
Right.
You start to find out what's common in that kind of article.
Right.
Yeah, and so what we've run into in showing scientists what we do and how we do it is that part of it is that they understand that the databases that we have online are at a very rudimentary level search. So for us in Hawaiian, one word can mean 4 different things, you know, at the least. So for us, it takes somebody with at least, you know, a mediocre skill set to be able to understand that when I search this one term, I then have to go in and cull out all the ones that are totally not related, although it's the same word. So we've done that. We've tried
to explain that. It's worth mentioning because the mindset of the scientists who wanted a particular set of data related around snow and ice. And so we looked up how, right?
Right.
But how has five or six meanings, and they didn't understand that you have to cull out four-fifths of these articles that'll have nothing to do with snow. And I guess they expected there was a metadata they were kind of anticipating.
Right. There was, well, I guess because for us in English, we could just look up snow and get things related to snow. But in Hawaiian, if I have to go in and you're looking up snow, so which means I have to look up hau, that means I have to call out anything about the plant, anything about the action, that striking action, you know. So it does, it takes time. It's not so quick. It's not really an instant gratification thing.
Right.
You know, it takes at least 5 minutes to go through the first page of results, you know. So for me, I have to be able, but that's partly, that's why I was hired, is I have to have the skill set to be able to cull out those things, identify the ones that I want, and then pull them. And then look at it as a whole, read through maybe a couple times to get a full picture. Because there are even times where they've used it as snow, but they've used it poetically, and it doesn't actually relate to an actual snow occurrence.
It's one of the nice things, though. The Hawaiian language is so poetic and beautiful. Makes it difficult for searching, I'm sure, but
it's one of its beautiful assets and it's one of its great roadblocks.
Well, Paige, you are doing some amazing work. It's so interesting to talk to you, and I hope to hear a lot more about your research in the future.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. We're going to take a quick break, and we are going to talk more about some of the historic fisheries information that we're gathering. Thanks.
Do you really want the federal government in control of the internet like Obamacare? The FCC is making a power grab right now and calling it net neutrality. Stand up today for a free internet, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion. Call the FCC, your senators and congressmen. Tell them you oppose so-called net neutrality. This message brought to you by NRB, National Religious Broadcasters.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. Last but not least, we have Monaco Tanaka here with us today. He is a master's student in the Hawaiian language as well, and working with the project on Hawaiian newspapers with Sea Grant at the University of Hawaii Manoa. Welcome to the show.
Aloha kakou.
Aloha. So we have been divulging all this amazing information
it's
about the
fabulous
research. I love, I'm so fascinated. Wish we had 3 hours to talk about this. Now, tell us, what makes your research a little bit different from Paige's? What are you focusing on?
Well, as you mentioned, I work with Sea Grant. So all of our goals are to look for things that are pertinent to fisheries, to fish. Everything that you think of basically when you hear sea is things that we're looking for. What some things that separate our research is that it doesn't have the scope that she does. We have there; it does potentially, but we try to keep it very based on those specific areas of fisheries and of fish. With that, we get a lot of interesting stories too. We just don't have to call necessarily as much. She mentioned an example of the word ho, which can be translated in six ways. Luckily, there are several fish that we could look up where if we find that fish, it's probably just about the fish. The counter side to that is that fish were common because they're food. You know, it's like doing a Google search for rice or potato. You know, you're gonna get a lot. So it's a different kind of struggle, but it also, because it's so present, it's so fish and ocean is so present, it's such an important part of the culture. It has so many different layers that we can attack it from, and it makes the research interesting for me, because then I can be more diverse with what we're pulling out for Sea Grant.
Right. And are the fish names the same, or have those shifted with time too?
Fish names are probably one of the most inconsistent things, I feel like, in Hawaiian. Because, you know, it's like anywhere else. It's regional, it's dialectical. There was no standard spelling, so there was all those things to consider. In fact, some of the most interesting articles I found have been people spending a good couple columns, which is about 3 or 4 pages typescripted, of just complaining because someone's been calling a fish by the wrong name. And that sounds
confusion.
Yeah. And it sounds silly, but that becomes very pertinent because managing fisheries in earlier times was a lot stricter, may have been more strict than it is today. They would have fish that you couldn't get at all, and it would just be declared through the newspapers. And so if you were declaring this fish couldn't be caught, and you're on Kauai, and then on Maui, they don't even call the fish by that name, then that declaration doesn't mean anything to them.
Interesting.
And so we have a lot of interesting dynamic. And I think that's one of the most interesting things about the newspaper is that prior to the newspapers, the islands didn't, you know, one island didn't have to know what another island called a fish. They went to fish for the fish they wanted. But when they started creating laws, when they had to have these kinds of interactions, the Hawaiian newspapers were a critical area to create those precedences and to define the boundaries of that.
So what's so fascinating to me is that there was emphasis on resource management, going back.
Mm-hmm. I want to comment on that.
Yeah,
just
please.
Because, I mean, one of the big differences that I see is your work with the fisheries and whatnot. Hawaii had such a deep tradition of management and of fishery systems. And
right.
So you're dealing more with cultural and historical stuff. Paige oftentimes ends up with the descriptive. I mean, and there's a personal or there's a cultural infusion kind of, but yours is almost embedded in that.
That's true. We have a lot, there's a lot of culture. I think we have, right off the top of my head, we have, you know, we get a lot of myths, we get a lot of religion, we get a lot of prayers, which to typical scientists may not be important, but, you know, things come up. Like one example I can think of is, and this is just in a discussion, not necessarily through my research, that there was research done on the opihi, the limpet.
Mm-hmm.
And the research that was done by whoever did the research, it was really like I was just walking somewhere and someone told me about it. They're saying that they believe that the opihi called the makayauli, which is one of the three types of opihi that are most easily recognized, came first, basically. And our the kumulipo, which is the chant that traces everybody back to the darkness, actually places the makayauli before the opihi. And so, you know, we can validate through science those cultural aspects. And that opens up whole new doors to understanding to the importance of Hawaiian mythology, even to the sciences. I think that's one cool thing about the research that we do.
Oh, just one of the many, I'm sure. Yeah. Are there a lot of resource lessons that you're finding from reading the articles that you think could be applied to present day?
I think it's so pertinent. When you're reading it, it's like you could be reading this week's newspaper. I think of one article written by a gentleman named Moku Mai'a. He was from Wanalua, where actually I'm from on the island. And he wrote this series of articles. And just to point out just one thing, he pointed out the canneries, because at the time, pineapple canneries were a big deal. This is the 1920s.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And he was saying that the runoff from the canneries is poisoning the ocean and no one realizes it. And he was telling the government this and advertising it in the newspaper and saying, I don't think anybody knows, but I've lived at these shores at Ke'ehi. I've been to places at Mokuae'o. And I see now this type of fish is here and it wasn't there before. I see lobsters floating around now for no reason, and then they don't understand why.
Yeah.
And this concerned them, and it was something that was observed because they're used to observing the land, probably more than you and I would. I don't always look in the canal over there, but I'll bet if I did every day, I might notice something. You know, there might be something changing all the time.
Sure.
And just putting myself in a mindset now where I become more aware of the environment around me. That's what this translation project has done for me. I didn't care much to look at every little thing, but now I try to look the way they looked at things, and that helps me to understand a little bit more about their perspective.
That makes me remember that the same author got real critical about the size of fish in the market and was arguing, and the man, the inspector who was in charge of that, ended up going head-to-head in the newspapers.
In the newspapers. He actually talked about, he wrote about his argument with an officer because he was so sure that he was correct, that you're making a big deal out of nothing. You don't understand what this is. And they were very critical. And it's I think it shows a sense of pride in fisheries and managing the oceans here and the conflict that came up when new people brought new systems in.
Can I admit, and not to intrude on your section, but also his articles pulled up the tension that happened when a new fishing method, you know, the throw net is not traditionally Hawaiian. And there were complaints about the use of the throw net, how that was depleting some of the sources. Interesting. Today, the throw net is considered a deep tradition. But it had a rough start.
Well, it's amazing that, you know, some of these conflicts and issues are the same 100 years later, you know?
Definitely.
Wow.
They had some really unique ones, too. They had, we found some articles that were about just using electricity. They basically threw a battery in the water and tried to shock the fish. We saw one where they would actually try to blast them in schools and just boom, all at once. And that was, and what was really interesting was some of the articles were against them, but some of them were saying, we are so lucky to have this new fishing technique. We're going to get so many fish this way.
Wow.
Depends on who's writing.
Yeah, it depends who was writing.
So are there a lot of similarities in the authors of the articles that you're reading? You know, are you seeing trends based on certain authors throughout the papers?
This is probably a good place to insert that this work is very worthwhile and opens up doors to a lot of new things, but we don't get to go through a very high volume of articles. And I think that's something that I just want to make sure is clear to everybody who hears about the project, that we've been, I mean, there have been a couple of different authors that we've gone through, but the time process to actually translate and look at each article doesn't allow us to have a huge diversity in the authors that we have. I do notice, though, one thing that has been obvious is that the people who write about the ocean, they cared about the ocean. They would write passionately about it. They would write passionately about the religion and the protocols that went with it.
And there were historically, there were experts that were asked to write on particular topics. Right. So there we do get a taste of a single author and can compare him with other ones. But Monaco's right is that the span is so large. And our work is still rather piecemeal, even though it seems like we're doing a great deal of it. We haven't had the luxury to sort of do like analysis of style or of political position, of some of these folks.
Right.
It's such a huge undertaking, what you all are doing. Just so we understand, what would be the time frame for you to properly look at one article?
The time frame for me would be different from Kumupuakea, but also different from a high school student. So typically for me to go through about a column, which represents actually quite a few pages, it could take anywhere from 3 to 5 hours of time on the first draft. To try to figure out every single word. Mm-hmm. Sure. And then to go back through it again, I would usually work together with Kumu. Basically, an 8-hour day could go to that column easily if you wanted to get it to the level where we can use it.
And they don't bring me their first draft.
No, we don't.
I mean, that's anymore. At this level. I mean, that works in other places. But at this level,
Well, we know Paige learned her lesson. Wow.
Show the bite marks.
I have to say that I am absolutely speechless and so humbled by the work that you all are doing. It is really fantastic. Thank you so much. I mean, I wish we had more time, but I look forward to hearing about the amazing work that will continue on with this project and all the exciting things that you, Pu'akea, are going to do in your retirement. I want to take a minute to thank our guests today for coming and speaking with us, as well as our sponsors, the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, Kosi Island Earth, and National Science Foundation. I'm Carly Weiner, and now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.